Hi, folks. It's Denise Howell. And next up on This Week in Law, Allie Liftig, Gordon Firemark, and Evan Brown join me to discuss TVs and law degrees, chilling hot file, texter liability, criminalizing revenge porn, and Evan knows when to stop. All next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Evan Brown. Episode 225, recorded August 30, 2013. Vanna's Robot. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by ProXPN. ProXPN is a virtual private network that allows you to use the internet the way it should be, anonymous and unfiltered. For 20% off your new account, go to proxpn.com/twit and use the code TWIL. Hi, folks. This is Denise Howell, and you've joined us for This Week in Law. We have an incredible panel of folks with us today to discuss the latest and greatest developments in the world of technology law. And this week, we're going to entertain you as well, as I hope we do every week. But in particular, this week, we're going to focus on some more entertainment-oriented issues in light of the fact that joining us today, we have lawyer Allie Liftig, who is the author of the TVs and Law Degrees blog. Hi, Allie.
Hi.
It's wonderful to have you. Folks who listen to the show regularly will remember that we've had James Daly and Ryan Davidson on before. They author the Law and the Metaverse blog. And Allie's blog reminds me a lot of what they do, whereas they focus on the arcane legal issues that might come up in comic books and movies of the more fantasy and science fiction genre. Allie focuses on the legal issues that come up in TV shows and takes them apart and gives you the analysis of, you know, did this person really break the law? Is this true to life? You know, are the writers playing fast and loose with our actual understanding of the law? Allie, how long have you been doing the site?
I actually just started it this past April. So that's why it's pretty new still.
It sounds really fun.
Yeah, it is actually. I was trying to mix in. I was an English major and then I went to law school. So I was trying to mix in both things I do into something to write about. And that's what I came up with.
So I know you've been following Pretty Little Liars and also Twisted.
Yeah, I just added that recently. It's one of ABC Family's newer shows, and it takes place in New York, so I figured that would be helpful to me.
Yeah, definitely.
The other one takes place in Pennsylvania, so I was looking up all the differences to make sure.
And then the other show, I'm sure people are interested, that you know, is loaded with legal issues to unpack, is Breaking Bad. And I haven't been able to read your currently up analysis of Breaking Bad because I'm not caught up to that point and it would spoil it for me. But I'm looking forward to catching up and reading
it.
Yeah. I won't be doing that now. But that's a fun one.
My most recent entry on that it was more of a regular recap than what my blog does with the other shows. Just because I thought of this idea in April. Breaking Bad has been on for years. I wish I thought of this idea when it first started, because that would definitely be a great one.
But yes, it would. Well, we're glad that you're gonna keep us informed as it wraps itself up. Also joining us today, returning to the show, is lawyer from Hollywood, Gordon Firemark. Hello, Gordon. Great to have you back.
Hi, Denise. Great to be here. Thanks. Looking forward to the day.
Yes, lots been going on the entertainment front that we have perhaps not been paying as close attention to with all the privacy developments in the United States recently. And we've been talking a lot about that on recent shows, of course, with my co-host, Evan Brown from Chicago, Illinois. Hello, Evan.
Hi, Denise. Happy Friday. It's great to be here. Looking forward to this conversation. Gordon, great to talk with you again. Allie, very nice to meet you. So it should be a lot of fun, as usual.
All right. Since we're planning to entertain you today, let's move right on over to Hollywood. So this is kind of a big deal. Just this week, in the last couple of days, a case that has been pending for a while against Hotfile was resolved in favor of the MPAA. And Hotfile, of course, is a cyber locker site that the MPAA has been after for some time. Has had a motion for summary judgment pending for a long time that the parties have been filing briefs about. The Second Circuit decision in Viacom versus YouTube, I believe, came down while the summary judgment pleadings were pending and may have shaded the court's decision because that's where we developed this whole notion that a site cannot be willfully blind to infringement that its users may be engaged in. And we don't know yet, do we, Gordon, whether those Second Circuit arguments carried the day here in the Ninth Circuit in the Hotfile case, because although we know the outcome of summary judgment, Hotfile lost, we haven't been able to see the decision yet. For some reason, it's still being written up or redacted. Do you know what's going on there?
Well, I don't know much more than what you've said, other than that, as you said, the court is going to redact the opinion to make sure that it's not divulging any sensitive information that may have been included in the pleadings in order to, obviously, to make the case. So what we're hearing is media reports, basically press releases from both sides of the case, putting their spin on what this ruling means and what it says. So the Hollywood side, the MPAA, is the Motion Picture Association of America, is saying, we won. They're saying that these cyber lockers can't be willfully blind. And, you know, if they have any inkling, basically, they have to take steps to take the stuff down. And Hotfile's arguing a little more in the direction of the Viacom approach, saying, well, no, willfully blind means, you know, that we've actually taken steps to avoid knowing. And I don't know, it's something weird there, too, because as I understand it, there are allegations in the Hotfile case that Hotfile was actually encouraging its users to post this copyrighted stuff. So I think there's a lot more to learn once this opinion comes out, which might be another week or two.
Right. I haven't really read through the summary judgment pleadings at all. Have just been following Eric Gardner's excellent coverage of the case as it has been unfolding. But the nugget in his coverage that caught my eye is that at one point the MPAA argued that Hotfile is actually paying users to upload, or was through an affiliate program to upload copyrighted information. How do you think that, of course, we're just kind of spitballing the seven because we don't know what the court's decision actually says yet. But how do you think that that kind of a fact would weigh into a case like this?
I think that's one of the facts that makes this a case that is making the court decide the way it is here. You know, the MPAA and its PR is saying, well, this is the first of its kind, the first decision of its kind. You know, this is the first time we've seen victory like this. And yeah, I guess that's right in as much as we're talking about the file locker situation. But it sounds like there are some pretty, if you want to characterize it this way, egregious facts that pertain to Hotfile here that make it more than just the typical file locker. It's not just a place where you go put files and you know, send links to some people to get other people to get those files. There was this affiliate program. There was much more activity. It sounds like it's more akin to the ISO Hunt case, you know, the Fung case from a few years ago, where there really were some facts pertaining to how the service was run that showed, first of all, knowledge on the part of the operator of the service. And that, of course, is going to be fatal to any DMCA 512 protection, you know, if it rises to this level. And this is the whole difficult question that's being presented by the YouTube and the Viacom case and the VO case and, you know, the different different iterations of that at the appellate level. So there's also that the factor of inducement here. And I think that's where the affiliate program becomes relevant. And I think that this is some pretty slick characterization on the part of the movie studios to say that they're actually paying people to upload mm-hmm. infringing content. That's, you know, that's stretching it a little bit. It's drawing a conclusion there. It's not like, hey, upload a copy of Rocky IV and you get, you know, $6 or something like that. It's a little bit more disparate, or you know what I mean? A little bit removed than that. But the bottom line is that plays into this whole notion of knowledge and inducement, which makes it a special type of case, one where we probably shouldn't be too surprised that Hotfile is on the losing end of this summary judgment motion.
Also on the losing end of the summary judgment, you guys, is the one of the principals of Hotfile, Anton Titov, who is a foreign national who happens to live in Florida. And so there's a lot of discussion about why Hotfile is why they were the ones that the MPA went after initially. And it seems to be because they can reach him. There's an actual person. And in this summary judgment, the court also ruled against him directly, personally. So that raises some more interesting tidbits. I'm really looking forward to reading this opinion.
Ali, any thoughts about file lockers and this particular case that we're discussing?
Yeah, I mean, what you were just saying, it definitely seems to be a major difference that they're saying that Hotwire is paying people to put up files that infringe copy, right? I think it's making it a lot worse for their outcome.
Yeah, I can certainly see where a court would get hung up on that issue. But as Evan was saying, the devil's in the details, and you would really need evidence. Again, you know, I'm sure someone who wanted to go through all of the summary judgment exhibits that are available for public view could see exactly, you know, whether infringing works were generating some sort of affiliate payback exclusively or other works too. I think that would be an important tidbit to know as this begins to go up on appeal, which, assuming that the funding is in place, it would certainly be the next step. The other thing that's interesting in here is there were counterclaims back against the MPAA here for allegedly abusing the site's anti-piracy tool. Apparently, the studios were able to delete or disable files that they thought shouldn't be on the site. And the counterclaim alleged that they were doing that willy-nilly and that sites that weren't infringing at all were being taken down. Apparently, that didn't go anywhere either, did it, Gordon?
Not really, no. The judge was pretty skeptical about everything in this from what we're reading again. And I hate to keep saying it, but we got to see the real opinion to know exactly right. What's going on here. But, you know, if a movie studio is able to identify a property of its on one of these sites and use the countermeasures to take it down automatically, I think it's a little disingenuous for the site to then say, well, wait a minute, you used that countermeasure improperly. But again, I don't know exactly what they were, how much of a movie they were grabbing at. And so I suppose there is a fair use argument that maybe they're catching things in the net that actually have a legitimate place up there.
Right. Hey, Gordon, there was a case that came out a bit ago now that I've been saving until we could have you on the show. Because I think it's really fascinating and has some broad ramifications beyond just video games. And it is the Ninth Circuit decision. We've discussed a couple of these cases as they were pending simultaneously before the Ninth Circuit over athletes in video games. One of them, they were decided together by the Ninth Circuit. One of them invoked the Lanham Act, so said that the athlete's trademark rights made it impossible for a video game company to use their likeness in a game. That one got knocked out. That one, the First Amendment came to the game company's rescue, and they said, no, you know, there is an exception to the Lanham Act, and we're going to protect the First Amendment ability to reproduce the person's likeness in the game. Now, the second one, the Keller case against EA, that's the one that seems a little bit more problematic because it invoked California's right of publicity statute. And what the court got kind of creative here and brought over a principle from copyright law, the fair use doctrine, tried to decide if EA's use of Keller's likeness in the game was transformative. So it was enough unlike him, I guess, they were looking for that you would perhaps think it was some generic other athlete who just bore a resemblance to Sam Keller.
And played for the same team and wore the same number.
Right, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, it seems kind of tortured what the court did here and, you know, by importing that standard. But under that standard, the court found a violation of Keller's IP law under this state law of publicity. So unpack that for us a bit, if you could, Gordon.
Well, you know, California has one of the broader right of publicity laws. And what a right of publicity is essentially is the right of usually any person, but mostly it's dealt with in the celebrity realm, to control the commercial use of their name and or likeness. And I think what the court was doing in the Keller case was saying that because this use was not transformative, it was very obviously Keller in his sort of native context, you know, on the playing field, wearing a uniform and so on. It's not transformative. You're using him as a tool to get people to buy this product. And you know, he has a right to license that usage, I guess. And what I read between the lines here is this notion that if they had taken him and put him into a dance party video game or something like that, maybe it would be a different story, because now he's not in his native context, for lack of a better phrase for that. What's interesting to me is that in both of these cases, the Jim Brown case and the Keller case, where Jim Brown was dealing with that Lanham Act concept, and in Keller we're dealing with the right of publicity, the courts are adopting copyright-like principles of fair use. You know, or applying the First Amendment, sort of using that fair use. And in the Jim Brown case, they basically said, no, what the game was doing was a fair use, you know, depicting the players on the field. And then turn around right there in Keller and saying, yeah, but doing that violates the right of publicity. Very, very peculiar. California, as I said, has this very broad right of publicity law that that goes beyond just name and likeness. And that's why Keller was able to do this. Because they didn't name the character in the game Samuel Keller, but they put him in the same uniform, wearing the same number, you know, playing on the same teams, those kinds of things. And so he was able to say, that's my persona. Those are indicia of my identity. And under California law, he was able to prevail. I don't know that, well, factually, I think that's going to play out a lot commonly among other cases as we see these things coming forward. So, my guess is we'll see a Supreme Court case eventually and get some resolution on this.
Right, because it seems like we may have a conflict with the Third Circuit.
And an internal split of authority within the Ninth Circuit.
Yeah. So yes, Supremes, get ready. This is headed your way, hopefully, in the near future. Some interesting tidbits from the EFF's coverage of this. First is the invocation of some older cases I thought were just interesting to know were out there. One where just evoking, two cases were just evoking a person's identity without trying to duplicate them with any kind of the same fidelity as we're seeing here in these video game cases. A phrase associated with a celebrity like "Here's Johnny" for Johnny Carson has triggered liability, and also a robot dressed like Vanna White, which I thought was pretty hysterical. Just the visualization of, I guess there was a case involving Samsung where they dressed up a robot like Vanna White for, you know, the fun and frivolity that that would entail. And,
well, and Vanna that robot was actually turning letters on a sign and that kind of stuff, doing what Vanna right. does. So you know, she would say, hey, that's clearly a jab at, not a jab at, but a depiction of something like me, and she sued and won. And yeah, so
right, that was back in the early 90s. So for all of you who were planning to dress as Vanna robots for the upcoming Halloween season, you might want to bear that case in mind. The other more sort of serious note from the EFF's coverage is bringing up the movie The Social Network, and how if this is going to be the principle, here's the exact language that EFF cites. The use does not qualify for First Amendment protection because it literally recreates the celebrity in the very setting in which he has achieved renown. Well, that would have presented or prevented the making of a movie like The Social Network because of the close resemblance of the character, or the intended close resemblance of the character to the real Mark Zuckerberg, or at least meaning to evoke that person. Evan, are you as concerned as the EFF seems to be about the impact of this decision?
Well, there certainly is grounds for concern, because that statement taken in isolation, you know, if we're not going to fully extend the metaphors of the use of a character or likeness in a video game to the use of a character or likeness in a movie, but we're just going to take that statement in isolation, then yeah, there's a great deal of concern to be had. You know, the court said something like, with the EA's primary emphasis was on reproducing reality. And so, yeah, if you're making a documentary or a dramatic adaptation of real life events that involved real people, certainly your main objective is going to be emphasizing a reproduction of reality. And that is problematic. And this, you know, so what I was talking about is saying that in the vacuum, taking that that statement as an abstraction, that causes some concern. I have a feeling that, though, if we were to fully work through the metaphor or the analogy of video games versus use in a documentary film, there's other interests that are at stake there that may make it more of a transformative use, because sports is also entertainment, whereas a film, you know, you could easily work in other uses there. Gordon, I heard you, you know, getting ready to say something, so I'm eager to hear what your comment is.
There are a bunch of distinctions between a feature film or a documentary or a novel or a book or a magazine article and a video game. The video game is interactive. There, you know, what the game company is essentially doing is selling a toolbox of characters and an engine to make those characters do what the player wants. And so it's a little different than when you're telling the ostensibly the real story of the founding and creation of Facebook, or you know, whether you're writing it as a piece of journalism or telling it as a narrative story in a film. The First Amendment's going to feel a little stronger there. What this comes down to is, where on the spectrum of commerciality does something like the video game fall relative to those other things? And when The Social Network was about to come out, a lot of us were talking about, hey, how did they do this without Zuckerberg's permission? And the speculation was that Zuckerberg would be a fool to try to stop it, because it would make him out to look like a bad guy. And so they took a calculated risk. But then as you got into it and started unpacking it, you said, wait a minute, it's a feature film. It's telling a true story. There's a social a value, a societal value to getting this information out there. And that's what the First Amendment is all about protecting. It's not about protecting Electronic Arts' ability to sell a video game you know, on the basis that you can have Sam Keller play football against your, you know, or on your fantasy team. I'm not sure that's a distinction with a difference, but that seems to be what the court's doing here.
Right. So if I'm understanding you correctly there, Gordon, you're thinking that a court might see more sort of social value to a film that tells a story than a video game that is interactive and tells a different kind of story and is more of an experiential thing. Both are obviously commercial enterprises. So how, you know, am I getting that right? Am I getting close to where the court.
There's a lot of court opinion and authority expressing that things like films and books and television programs are expressive in their nature and not commercial for the purposes of this right of publicity analysis, whereas there isn't such authority relating to the video games. So this case seems to be the beginning of that kind of authority saying, no, it's not expressive speech covered by the First Amendment that way. So that's what leads me to the idea that maybe it's more commercial in its... Well, it's being interpreted as more commercial.
And what do you think of that? I mean, I can certainly conceive of arguments around video games where, you know, this is very, very expressive. Minecraft pops to mind, you know, where...
Well, except that it's not the seller of the game's expression. Mm-hmm. They're putting, like I said, this toolbox, these characters and things on the playing field, and then the game player creates the narrative that unfolds. And so That's the distinction that I'm looking at. Not sure I agree with it, but that's what it seems to be.
Right. I mean, it seems like we're going to need a case to come along. And in the event, video games should be treated just as expressively as books and movies. Someone's going to need to make that argument.
Well, a few weeks ago, I actually was interviewed on the subject of machinima, which is where filmmakers, cinematographers essentially take these video game engines and make films by recording scenes that they've created in the game and then cutting them together as films. So that it really does sort of cross the line and blur the line, I should say. And so it'd be interesting to see what happens. Maybe a machinima case will be what does it.
Right. Allie, what do you think about that distinction? Movies and books are expressive storytelling vehicles, but maybe TV would, I guess, get swept into that too. But video games should be treated differently.
I'm not sure about that. And I was also wondering if it mattered. I know The Social Network, before it was made into a movie, there was also a book. I read it. I don't know about you guys. It's called The Accidental Billionaires. And it was the same concept, except a book version before the movie came out. And I remember the end said that Mark Zuckerberg declined to contribute and help them, but Eduardo Saverin was cooperative in it. So I wonder if that has anything to do with how it was allowed to happen, because they did have somebody from the real story helping them, giving them a content.
Yeah, do you think that insulates the writers of either the book or the film, Gordon?
Well, I think having more corroboration for the facts and events that are depicted, that now we're getting into the defamation analysis, starts to show this is true. And a true depiction is certainly going to be, you know, a lot harder to stop than a false one. But it doesn't address the right of publicity, the right to use Zuckerberg's name to portray a character of him. Now, they're not using his likeness, so it just comes down to using his name, putting it on a character. And they didn't call the movie Zuckerberg the movie, which would be a more commercial use of his name to sell tickets to the film.
It does seem like there's a distinction here between what was going on in these video game cases and what was going on in the Social Network movie. There, they very proactively were portraying Facebook and its personnel. In the game, as you pointed out, Gordon, there were strong resemblances, but nobody said this was Sam Keller or any of the other athletes that were involved. And in fact, I'm assuming, now again, I haven't gone through and don't know all the tidbits of evidence. Maybe you know better than I do, Gordon. I'm assuming that there was probably, you know, the standard kind of language that we're used to seeing in books and other formats, just saying, you know, all instances of resemblance to persons living or dead are purely accidental. I'm assuming they did some kind of CYA that way. Do you think that kind of thing matters in this sort of case?
You know, does it matter? I'm not exactly sure. You know, in fact, I think with The Social Network, it went the opposite direction, and the announcement was this is based on true events. So they're not disclaiming it; they're actually claiming it, and that's a marketing decision more than anything else.
So we've got something different going on in this game.
Yeah, I mean,
cake.
I suppose if the video game popped up that splash screen and says, you know, any similarity to person's real or not, you know, living or dead, whatever, maybe that would have some impact on this kind of analysis. But, you know, we're talking about team colors and jersey with numbers on them and what position he played and, you know, those kinds of things. And I think a lot of the statistical characteristics of the player, I'm not a sports guy, so I couldn't get into it too much, but you know what I'm saying? If this person has this, if this character has the same stats as Keller, at what point can you get away? At what point can you no longer get away with saying this isn't Sam Keller just because you didn't put the name on it?
Evan, maybe getting back to something that one of our favorite guests, Professor Goldman, always stresses, you know, you've got to have that solid click-through agreement. Maybe we'd see evidence in a case like this of testimony from some sort of movie studio executive that they've played the game and clicked through on something that resemblance to persons living or dead is purely accidental. Maybe that would hold water. What do you think?
Well, that's an interesting theory. I mean, I think with something this nuanced, it's going to be a lot more, you know, sophisticated of an analysis than that. But, you know, I get the sense that when we're talking about this stuff and we really start splitting hairs on, you know, the right of publicity stuff here and whether somebody can be featured in a movie, you know, because, you know, we've spent more time, it seems like, talking about the Zuckerberg movie and, you know, this other hypothetical use that's propositioned in this EFF post than we have talking about the actual video game stuff. Seems like we're losing sight of the fact of the important speech interest here. And, you know, we're concerned about what the Ninth Circuit has said in this one instance, and we're kind of taking it here. I mean, do we really expect that we're going to be involved in a situation where, you know, we enjoy as a society this environment where there have been all kinds of biographies over the years of people living and dead? I mean, I just can't imagine it surviving First Amendment scrutiny to say that, you know, for example, you couldn't write a biography about somebody who's living or do a documentary about them. It's just there's ground for concern here, but man, it just seems like that would be really far-fetched for it to, you know, I'm just saying, maybe we should step back a little bit.
Well, and that's why these statutes talk about commercial uses of the name and likeness. And I think when you write the biography about a person, yeah, you're using their name to sell the book, but you're telling this ostensibly true account of the person's life. And back to the question of social value and what the First Amendment's there to protect, you know, the First Amendment's very strong in that area. And I just don't see that this video game is biographical. It's really just making the character a product, at least arguably. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That goes to that point we were talking about earlier, the difference in it, which I think is important. It's just what I was just like thinking about, and you actually articulated it. Thanks.
Yeah.
So commercial speech, for those that aren't lawyers and haven't been to law school, the First Amendment, the jurisprudence says we are allowed to regulate commercial speech more than we are artistic or expressive or political speech. And that's why this distinction matters.
Yes. And per the prompting of Sue the writer in IRC, we're going to drop in a passphrase for those of you listening to the show for continuing legal or other professional education credit. And we've got to make it persons living or dead, since that's been bandied around quite a bit in this discussion. If you'd like more information about that, head on over to the Twit Wiki at wiki.twit.tv. Find the This Week in Law page, and there's lots of information, whether you're a lawyer or perhaps in another profession that enables you to get professional credit for learning about things like the nuances of recent decisions in the tech law arena. Go on over there, and hopefully you'll be able to further your accreditation with whatever board it is that looks after your licensing or other professional education concerns. So thanks, Sue, for the prompting of our passphrase, our first passphrase for the show. And we may as well take a break right here and thank our sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, which is ProXPN. For those of you who've been listening to the show for the last couple of months, you know already that ProXPN is a global virtual private network that works with almost any internet connection. What we've got with ProXPN is a secure encrypted tunnel through which all of your online data passes back and forth. Now, any online application can work with ProXPN. That means your web browser, your email, if you are using a file locker or any kind of tool that helps you move information around the web, instant messaging, all of that, ProXPN keeps it hidden from prying eyes. It disguises your physical location and gives you unfettered access to any website or online service, no matter where you live or travel to. So recently, I was down in Mexico and hoping to have the same Netflix kind of experience that I have here in the United States. And ProXPN is perfect for that kind of situation because Netflix didn't know that I had traveled to Mexico in that particular instance. So that's just now. One. It does now. Yeah. Hi, Netflix. I went to Mexico.
So high maintenance.
Let's go read that license agreement.
Gotta go to Mexico. Gotta have my Netflix. High maintenance. Anyway, go on. Sorry.
Yeah, I know. Well, you know, ProXPN addresses lots more than just first world problems. It addresses, you know, helping make sure that what you do online is between you and your computer and not necessarily your ISP or anybody else who might be paying attention. So what you get is complete online privacy through a 512-bit encryption tunnel. It works via OpenVPN or PPTP. You get to choose. You can protect yourself against your ISP's six strike rule. So, you know, if you're someone who's engaged in a lot of activity online, whether you're uploading large files such as this show, for example, you know, when I'm done with the show and we're trading things around with the studio, I'm always wondering, you know, okay, is this going to set off some kind of alarm because I'm moving a lot of traffic around? And of course, I'm not engaged in anything that should trigger my ISP's six strike regime. And I certainly wouldn't, you know, it's nicer not to have to deal with that headache if you're not in the position of actually being the wrongdoer. So it's, you know, we know that VPNs can protect you from that kind of activity. And that would be one reason to check this out. Another one would be to keep your personal internet usage private at work. You can bypass internet filtering and blocked websites if that is an issue for you. You can bypass geographical restrictions for internet content and online video. And there are worldwide servers for ProXPN in the US, UK, Asia, and more. It makes your internet connection region free. Its software for Windows and Mac offers advanced controls, allowing you to select the programs and ports that you want to use anonymously to route your ProXPN, to route through ProXPN's servers. It also works with your iOS or Android device, allowing you to use your data plan or public or corporate Wi-Fi with complete and total privacy on the go. Very important. There's a new ProXPN app for Android and in the Google Play Store that supports OpenVPN. So if you are an Android person, definitely check that out. There's world-class customer support. And Steve Gibson loves this product. Definitely check out his more detailed analysis of how it works and why it's worth your time. So go to proxpn.com/twit for more information and to sign up. ProXPN premium accounts are usually $9.95 a month or $4.95 for the entire year. But don't do that. We've got a much better offer for you. Use the code TWIL and you'll get 20% off the lifetime of your entire account. That's less than $5 a month on the yearly plan. If you're not satisfied, you can cancel within 7 days for a full refund. So go to proxpn.com/twit and sign up with the code TWIL. Thank you so much, ProXPN, for your support of This Week in Law. All right, well, we just did a sponsored bit of discussion here on our show, and we've definitely been talking recently when we had Comply's CEO Tom Chernak on the show, if I've got that right, about the various requirements under the FTC guidelines for disclosing when you are doing something in connection with a sponsor. Actress Olivia Spencer was doing precisely the right thing. She's one of the people who starred in the movie The Help. She gave an Oscar-winning performance in that film. And apparently she partnered up with a weight loss company called Sensa. Entered into a contract with them where she was going to lose some weight and have a healthier, you know, promote a healthier lifestyle. She was very conscious that she entered into this contract wanting to have it be a classy experience, not have pictures of, you know, before and after splashed all over tabloids and things. So she passed up other contracts before she went ahead and went with this one because it was much more what she had in mind. And per her contract, she specified that she was going to comply with the FTC guidelines on sponsorship. But apparently the sponsorship, the whole arrangement didn't go as well as the sponsor wanted it to. According to Octavia's lawsuit that she's now filed, one of the reasons that Sensa tried to cancel her contract is that she put the hashtag spawn on her tweets, you know, hashtag S-P-O-N, indicating that I'm tweeting about Sensa and it's a great product, but this is a sponsored tweet. They didn't like that. They thought it undermined their advertising campaign. They sent her a cease and desist letter and terminated her contract for this. So she's kind of darned if she does, darned if she doesn't. She's trying to comply with the FTC guidelines and live out her contract. But now she's alleging in her lawsuit anyway that they use this as an excuse to terminate things. Are we going to see more and more of this kind of back and forth, Gordon, you think, with celebrities trying to make their way through the FTC guidelines?
Well, I expect we probably will. I mean, I think this is going to be a cautionary tale, and those of us that are drafting these kinds of contracts or negotiating them are going to negotiate the provisions in there that, you know, it shall not be a grounds for termination or, you know, deemed a breach of this contract if we take action in compliance with state or federal regulations, you know, something along those lines. And that's exactly what happened here. But it was in the contract. So yeah. This is puzzling to me. Yeah, I think the, you know, the subtext here is the endorsement didn't really play out the way Sensa wanted it to, and they were actually seeing the numbers, the responses to Spencer's social media posts being just, you know, not performing well, less interesting than their own regular advertising messages, and so right. You know, this is sour grapes. At least that's the way she characterizes it.
Right. So, Allie, this seems like something that could come up on one of your shows, you know, maybe more of a reality show. The Kardashians, for example, might, they definitely engage in the kinds of speech on Twitter that could get them in trouble with both the FTC or their endorsing companies if they don't do it properly. Do you think that we're going to see more controversy about this, or is it pretty clear cut and people should just do the right thing?
I mean, I don't happen to follow those two examples of people on Twitter, but I could see that becoming more of a problem. In the case you were just talking about, I am not familiar with that particular one, but was there anything in her contract saying that she couldn't indicate that the tweets were sponsored, or they just didn't like the results after?
In fact, it looks like her contract said exactly the opposite, that everything she did was going to be in compliance with the FTC guidelines. And so, you know, she's I think, in a pretty good legal position here, that shouldn't have been grounds for terminating her contract. What do you think, Evan?
Well, that's what the complaint says. You know, I mean, I'm looking at it right now. there's obviously much more to this story than what we know. We have an article written about a complaint, which is one side's version of the story. So, you know, the best we can tell is it's a relationship that's gone wrong here. You know, the agreement says one thing, but I don't think that it, I mean, I certainly have never seen a litigated matter be as clear cut as what we would think it would be if the contract said she can do it, she did it, and they terminated the contract over that. There's something obviously more to it here. And I think Gordon was addressing that squarely on. This is a situation where the sponsorship relationship has gone bad. Things like these are measured by such subjective criteria. The expectations are so high of the parties when you go into transactions like this. Like, oh, you know, we've got an Academy Award-winning actress. We're going to make $1 billion over this relationship. I'm surprised to see that she has less than 200,000 followers on Twitter, you know, and that it was like a well over $1 million deal for her as well. So there's just something, there's some more bizarre undercurrents going on in this transaction.
I also think this was not a particularly well-managed endorsement agreement in the first place, because, you know, the ones I've seen generally have included either as an exhibit or just in the body of the agreement, you know, some provision that here are the approved messages we want you to circulate and we'll periodically update them or something like that. And so if she was writing these messages herself and they weren't being, you know, created by the sponsor, you know, that seems to be a failing on their part. You know, you want to get a good message out, write the message, and then get your celebrity endorsers to get them out there.
Otherwise, it's a very lengthy endorsement agreement. My gosh, it's like 16 pages at least.
Yeah.
So yeah, you'd think that if they were going to go to that detail, there would have been a statement of work or an insertion order or whatever you'd call it in that context.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Well, let's leave Hollywood for a bit and talk a little bit about things going on the privacy front.
Anything going on there?
Oh, there's always stuff going on there. One of the things going on is we've talked about this before on the show. Speaking of sponsored things, you remember the Facebook sponsored stories controversy. And the fact that Facebook has agreed to pay $20 million to users who had their information used in sponsored stories ads. That was the proposed settlement, and that settlement has now been approved. So there's really, if you didn't opt into the Fraley versus Facebook settlement, there's really nothing you can do at this point. I think May was the deadline to get yourself in for your chunk of that $20 million, whatever that may be. It looks like it maybe pencils out to about $15 per user, which, you know, is better than a slap in the face, sure. Apparently that settlement has been approved and that's going forward. And I guess it's a timely thing to consider in the wake of the fact I just got an email from Facebook. They're apparently alerting users by email now when they are updating their privacy policies and putting it out for user comment. And they are in the middle of that kind of period once again, so hopefully to insulate themselves from similar kinds of concerns in the future. Evan, anything to add to this?
No, I mean, it's just been interesting to see how the whole class action process has worked here. The judge rejecting the settlement agreement, I think, twice, and so, you know, sending it back to the parties in the sense of equity here. So that's been, for me, the most interesting thing about all this. As far as the substance goes of it, you know, not too much to say there. Class action lawsuits get filed all the time. People who watch the show know what I think about them. I think they're largely not well-founded or, they, you know, whatever. I'm not even want to get into it.
We'll just order some tacos and get them delivered to your office, Evan.
Thank you. I'd be very happy with that. Appreciate it.
Sure. All right. So, Gordon, any thoughts about this?
I do have some. In fact, what I want to point out is, you know, we were talking about the right of publicity cases with the athletes a little while ago. And here what we have is Facebook paying people for the privilege of having used their pictures and names in advertising. So, we're very clearly on the commercial end of that spectrum we were talking about, but that's what's going on here. So
it is. We couch this as a privacy story, and it's often discussed as a privacy story, but it is really more of a data story. You know, your name, your likeness, your activity as something that you have a property interest in.
Yeah. Well, and the right of publicity is often, and it's an offshoot of the right of privacy. So it's appropriate that this is here. It's hard to argue that this decision is bad. I mean, Facebook was using that stuff without people's permission. My picture would show up next to a promoted post or a sponsored message of some sort. What's different, of course, is that it's not a video game. It's not it doesn't have a narrative to speak of other than to sell a product. So that's all I have to say.
All right, Allie, any thoughts?
I mean, that seems more of a directly commercial use that would be almost more of a problem. It doesn't seem like they're trying to express anything of artistic value.
Definitely.
Exactly.
No, I think about the only thing Facebook can fall back on here is that we want to tailor the advertising experience to be something that's actually not intrusive, something that actually is useful to you, something that resonates with you and that, you know, isn't just a royal pain. But that doesn't seem to have helped them out at all in this context.
Yes.
So let's move on to another sort of everyone up in arms kind of story. Apparently, and this was broken by the Huffington Post, there is a top U.S. safety official named Deborah Hirschman, who made some comments about putting the essential equivalent of a black box into self-driving cars, such as the ones that Google is working on. So the idea is there, you know, we've talked a lot about, okay, well, how will the liabilities shake out for these self-driving cars? And that seems to be what this safety official wants to address. You need to have data about what the car was doing in the event there was, you know, some terrible catastrophe ensues. There's got to be good data, she says, at the Governor's Highway Safety Association's annual meeting. Good data demonstrated and good data captured. So although, you know, this is not any sort of requirement or a law that has gone into place, these were just concerns that were voiced by this safety official about capturing data from these cars. And of course, in the wake of all the revelations about other data that's being captured about U.S. citizens, this raised some eyebrows. You know, do you really want your car that is capable of saying a lot about you through its metadata to be able to report that back at will when somebody gains access to its black box? What do you think about this concept, Evan?
There's some interesting things going on here. First of all, Deborah Hirschman, she's really good at public relations. She was the one, kind of the voice of the NTSB after the Asiana crash, you know, mm-hmm. a few weeks ago. So she's really good, I think, with the public. And we've got to keep her comments in perspective. She's the chair of the National Transportation Safety Board. So she wants to, her mission, her objective, her obligation is to do everything that she can to ensure that there's enough data to investigate when there are accidents. So I think for us, what we really need to think of here is, what is the real privacy interest or the privacy risk that's at stake? The quick answer to that is, well, the government's going to keep track of everywhere that I go. And so we can quickly take this into the context of the conversation that we have when we're talking about the U.S. versus Jones or any GPS decision for that matter. You know, should the mm-hmm. government have the right to have information about you, you know, where you're going? And then it becomes this weird question, well, how is that information private if it's just information about you where you are in a public place? You know, come on, by definition, it ain't private, right? Because this is about where you are in public. And that's the whole conversation that Justice Sotomayor and Justice Alito had in the concurring opinions of the Jones decision, the Supreme Court decision that came out in January of 2012. So I think the quick solution to all this is to recognize, sure, there is a very important interest in having the data available to investigate crashes. But all you need for that is what happens in the seconds right before the accident happened. How fast was the car going? Did he or she apply the brakes? Were the brakes in working order? Was the transmission working? What was the fuel level? You know, all that important data that goes to the investigation of the accident. What's not important is where that car may have happened to have been 10 days earlier, engaging in a drug transaction. That's not important to investigating the wreck. So I'm all for seeing that there are black boxes there. I think that's a good use of technology, but let's make sure that there are limited restrictions. I think the two most important restrictions that would be on this is making sure all the data is just locally stored in the black box itself and not phone homed to an NSA data center. I'm sorry, NTSB data center. And also making sure that's a really short buffer. For the reasons that I was just talking about, you don't need to know where you were 10 days before to investigate this accident. All you need is the 5, 10, 15 seconds right before the accident occurred, which is perfectly, I see no privacy implication with that information being made available after an accident.
Right. That sounds very reasonable to me. What do you think, Allie?
Yeah, I think similarly, because there is similar, it's allowable if it's not a self-driving car, if it's information about an actual driver. You're on a public road. There is no right to privacy as to where you are if you're driving on the public road, public visibility, but it would need to be limited. Like, I don't think you should be able to get anything from that black box that isn't relevant to the accident and how it happened.
But isn't that right. A slippery slope that we start heading down? If I mean, I'm playing devil's advocate here a little bit. I think these black boxes are probably...
No, 15 seconds. 15 seconds. That's where the slope begins and ends. You get 15 seconds of data.
Yeah, because otherwise that's dangerous to... Like, I don't think everything that happened in the car that's completely not relevant to an accident situation, and I don't think that should be readily available.
Okay, so let's talk about relevance for a second. So shouldn't logging when the brakes were last serviced also be something that's recorded in these black boxes and kept longer than 15 seconds? That's what I mean by slippery slope.
Oh,
right. Right, or the fact that the driver just received a text. And of course, in the self-driving car, that's irrelevant, right? You should be able to go back and forth all you'd like because your car is driving itself. But
we've seen our computers get bogged down when a big email message comes in or something like that. So maybe,
maybe jamming up the system. Well, interestingly, there is this case that came down in New Jersey this week that involved liability, and we're sort of moving out of privacy, but staying on the theme of cars here and whether they should drive themselves and what the drivers who are driving the cars should be doing. What this case discussed but did not find on its particular facts was liability for people sending texts to drivers, and seemed to be discussing a world in which we would assume that the law, that drivers would follow the law. And if they're not supposed to be looking at texts or emails or otherwise distracting themselves while they are driving, we're going to assume that they are following the law on the one hand. But on the other hand, if the sender knows or has reason to know that the person is driving and that they would interrupt their driving and distractedly look at the text that they sent, then perhaps the sender of the text could actually have some responsibility for the accident. Now, this seems like a plaintiff's PI lawyer's dream, this kind of decision. But I don't know that it's really going to have any impact because the case settled out of court against the driver, and the person sending the text was not actually found to be liable here. The court just sort of mentioned this in passing, which is what we call dicta in the legal world, and doesn't really have any legal impact. Evan, do you think that people should be nervous about this decision?
I didn't realize it was dicta. I thought this was an actual issue before the court as to whether or not this sender of the text could be liable. So I don't know. I mean, we can discuss that, later.
Well, I'll read the opinion. Maybe I'm characterizing that wrong. It was before the court whether she was liable or not, and she was found not to be liable. But under that circumstance, you know, I guess the court laid out circumstances in which she could be liable, but we're not finding her liable here.
What I read the court doing was articulating a standard by which the facts before it were to be evaluated. You know, it held that it's not the law is not such that you can never be liable for sending a text. What the court held, the test that are articulated, is you can mm-hmm. indeed under some circumstances be liable for sending the text if you know or have reason to know that the person who's receiving the text is going to look at it and be distracted. Mm-hmm. So,
a workable standard?
Absolutely. I think the court got it right here. Because, I mean, this is something texting, distracted driving is a huge problem. You know, the poor plaintiffs in this case it was a husband and wife, they each lost their left leg. This is a very, very serious problem. And if the kid hadn't been texting, it wouldn't have happened. I don't know. The case settled out of court. We don't know. But I think it's pretty safe to assume that it wouldn't have happened. And there's certainly is enough going on here. So, this is the kind of case that lends itself very easily to sensationalist reporting that gets the holding wrong. You know, well respected players in mainstream media got the headlines wrong, saying send a text, be responsible. That's not what the case holds at all. It's if the facts specifically show that you have reason to know that the person getting the text at that time is going to look at it and be distracted by it, you can be responsible. I see no problem with that. Whatsoever. And I also have no trouble imagining situations where the sender of a text would do something to induce the recipient of the text to respond right away. I think the court got this right.
Well, we were kind of joking around on Twitter before the show about this because you said you could imagine a circumstance where you would send a text to someone and it would be distracting enough text in one way or another that you know that they're going to interrupt their driving and be distracted. Yes. And, you know,
Did anybody else get that Amber Alert last week or the week before where I guess the government was sending out an emergency message that had a different kind of an alarm sound? That came to every iPhone. And so is the government liable for distracting drivers who stop to look at what the heck is happening with my phone?
You know? That's yes.
One sort of peculiar extension of this notion. But also, I got to say, if distracting the driver is the threshold for liability, then I've got three kids in my back seat that are violating it every single day.
Yeah.
You know, and
the court actually used examples like that, you know, it quoted extensively from the restatement of law, you know, for torts, talking about, joint liability for things like this. And that actually was an example. And, you know, it is the duty of the driver to not remain distracted, but it's also there can come a point where conduct on the part of someone else. And of course, all the examples that the court used are where the person is physically present, that we had in the notion of this case being electronically present, by sending the text. And, you know, talking to that specific example about the government, I thought along those lines because, my firm, we represent a lot of companies who are, using text messaging as a means of promotion. It's like, a company sends out a text about a promotion. Is that going to give rise to liability? And let me read from the opinion. And I actually wrote this up on my firm's blog at infolawgroup.com a couple of days ago. It says, one should not be held liable for sending a wireless transmission simply because some recipient might use his cell phone unlawfully and become distracted while driving. And this is where it gets good. Whether by text, email, Twitter, or other means, the mere sending of a wireless transmission that unidentified drivers may receive in view is not enough to impose liability. So whether or not that's dicta or whether or not the court was articulating the standard by which it needed to compare those facts, I think it's pretty clear that just sending something out, not knowing the state of the mind or the circumstances of what where the recipient is going to what the recipient is going to do with it won't make you liable. But there are all kinds of situations where the sender really could be responsible. A rated G version. I know what you were thinking, Denise. You
thought yes, I was thinking of the not rated G version.
Oh my gosh! I don't even know what you're talking about.
But I really can't conceive of a version of any rating where the sender really has any notion whatsoever what the driver's going to do with a text. Even if they did know that the person was driving at the time.
Okay, hypothetically, you're the parent of a 16-year-old kid. Mm-hmm. They're a terrible driver. And you know that he or she has the habit of texting all the time when he or she is driving, whether you want them to or not. But you know that that's their habit, something you're trying to break them of. You find out that they have done something while they're out and about. You get a call from the neighbor, said, "Hey, I just saw your son Johnny drinking a beer while driving, and he was texting, by the way. Do something about it." So you then send a text saying, "Johnny, get home right now. Or else, whatever, I'm taking the keys away." You know, you should expect that Johnny's going to read that text because you know he has that proclivity. And you've also put a threat to it as well. He doesn't want to lose his license. So by golly, he's going to look at that and you want him to act on it. I think that's a perfectly plausible situation. Let's hope let's hope that our 16-year-old kids don't go around doing stuff like that. But it's still plausible.
Right. Talk about darned if you do and darned if you don't. Try and stop your kid from having an accident and cause one at the same time. Okay. Yeah, no, I'll take that as an example. But I think you'd have to have really unique circumstances where you could be said to know with certainty what a driver is going to do with a text when it is received. Anybody else have other thoughts, Allie?
I agree with you. I think it would be a really, I understand it's an attempt at a safety precaution to implement something like this, but I think that standard is really broad, like a parent-child relationship. Yeah, maybe the parent knows how the child is likely to react while driving, but I think a lot of issues would come up, you were saying a joint and several liability. A driver could receive texts from a bunch of different people. And how do you know which sender would know how the driver would react versus another sender? I think it would be difficult to do.
Well, you look to the state of mind of the sender, not the driver. That's where discovery.
Right.
I think that would be hard to prove. It would be really a different case by case, the state of mind of a sender of a text message.
Well, and that's exactly what the court says. It's not the court did not hold as a matter of law that you're always going to be liable. And that's a good thing. That's why we have finders of fact. And that's precisely what the court did, says this is something that the finder of fact should do. And, it's going to depend. In order for you to be successful in this, you have to show facts that prove that the sender had knowledge or reason to know that the sender. And I don't know why I'm getting so worked up over this, I guess I just don't want people to misunderstand it, because I think this is a really important pro public safety, a very well measured pro public safety opinion that a lot of people are getting upset about, but the court is not doing really anything here to restrict our freedoms to text. It's just imposing a real important public responsibility standard on us here. If you know that you're going to send a text to somebody and you know, or have, you know, a specific reason to know that they're going to be distracted by that, you shouldn't do that. And if you do, you're responsible. That seems totally sensible to me.
You don't see a First Amendment issue there, huh?
No, I think that that's a compelling government interest to keep people from losing their legs and their life and limb and life in auto accident.
Yeah, and there's incitement rules as well. Okay, yeah, you're right.
Yeah, I had a perfect example of you know, triggering this potential liability. Yesterday, I was driving to meet some friends at the zoo, and we were late, and they were there and didn't know if I was in the parking lot or possibly in the car, probably still in the car since we weren't there, texted me to say, okay, we're out front, blah, 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 texted me while I was driving. And I would, I didn't respond to the text or looked at the text. I heard the little ding and go, oh, there they are. You know, they're probably wondering where we are. At which point I called, you know, hands-free and all, letting them know that we were running a little late. But goodness, I would hate to have the fact that the person knew I was in the car and or probably was in the car and texted me trigger liability for causing an accident, which thankfully we had a good trip to the zoo and it did not involve any accidents. But
I'm going to say it one more time, but then I'll get off of it because I'm annoying myself at how I'm getting. This case would not prohibit that conduct. You would still have to show that the sender of the text knew not just that you were in the car, but knew that you would be in the car and distracted. Right. So that's it. I'm done.
Okay. Let's not annoy ourselves, please. Yeah. We know we've beat something to death when we run into that. Okay, we have to do a second MCLE passphrase. And let's make it a distraction in honor of that interesting discussion and case. And Evan, I hadn't read your write-up yet of the New Jersey appellate court decision, but I just put it in our discussion points for anyone who would like to read through everything that we have discussed on the show at delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/225. So you can get some more detail from Evan over there. Let's move on to the legislation and policy front, if we could.
Not even going to say it. Not even going to do it. I'm just going to dance in my head.
Well, I hope it's not evoking any sort of ancient 1970s television theme song strongly enough that we could have a write a publicity issue over it. but let's take a look at, I don't know how we could skip a story that involves twerking necessarily. And Miley Cyrus on MTV, blah, 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 controversy. Just the legal spin on that I found interesting was that the McCain unbundling bill got some support over it. Because the parents that were up in arms about Miley and her performance would like very much to be able to deselect MTV from their cable lineup and be able to order their channels a la carte. So they threw in behind the McCain bill and which is known as the Television Consumer Freedom Act. That would pressure cable providers to allow their customers to pick and choose the channels they pay for, as more written up in more detail by Brendan Sasso at Silicon Valley. Giving a little boost there. I really don't know what's up with the McCain Act, but that seems like a reasonable desire on consumers' parts. Of course, this all gets very complicated as to whether television becomes more expensive when you unbundle it or less expensive. But certainly the right to view the kinds of programming, have the kinds of programming in your house that you would like to have is a strong interest. Allie, as someone who deconstructs television for fun and recreation, what do you think about either Miley or the McCain bill or anything along these lines?
I could definitely see how after that performance it could invoke parental concern on what channels are being, like, they're paying for. But I don't know, because they also have the right to place restrictions on channels. Like, even if you're getting MTV, you can place a restriction so your children wouldn't be able to watch it. So I'm not sure, because I know some cable companies might, as you said, make it more expensive if you want to do something like that. like get rid of MTV, for example, you might wind up paying more money, and I don't know if that's really right, but it is how it works.
Right, exactly. Hey, Gordon, what do you think of the McCain bill? Is it looking promising?
I don't know if it's looking promising. I think the cable and satellite TV industries have pretty strong lobbies, and it's hard for consumers to match what they bring to the table. But you know, and personally, as a consumer of these things, yeah, there are a few channels that I want to pay for, and a lot on my satellite service that I don't care one bit about. And if I could save a little money by, you know, eliminating those, great. But if I have to ask myself, if I could only pay for the channels I wanted, would I still be willing to pay the amount that I do today? And I think I would. So it sort of comes out of wash for me. But, you know, one of the issues that comes up when you start to unbundle and consumers start to do that is you silence the minority voices that only get to be in front of consumers and occasionally get viewed, you know, that we just wouldn't have those subscribers. I'm thinking, for example, you know, do you care about C-SPAN enough to pay for it? Do you care enough about National Geographic? Maybe you do, maybe you don't. But they sometimes air very important documentaries that have messages that are worthwhile, at least to be available for us to see. And if we don't have the channel, we never hear about it. So that's my policy problem with the idea of unbundling.
Right. Well, my favorite take that I've read so far on the Miley MTV performance was Bob Lefsetz pointing out that it wasn't racy. Sure, it was racy, but that wasn't really the issue with it. It was just bad. And, you know, sad statement on the state of the music industry and where things are going. Evan, any thoughts here?
The best reaction to Miley Cyrus was Mark Randazza's over at Legal Satyricon. I can't even begin to quote from it because it was so laden with expletives. So, but it hits the nail right on the head. you know, the whole thing about tying it in with the McCain bill is like, wow, this is some great, you know, dot connecting here. And it takes a little bit of mental gymnastics to see the whole reasoning behind why they would take this to make to go into support of a piece of legislation like this. And so I can follow along and do some mental gymnastics to it as well. I mean, the real key issue is that the consumer should drive demand here, and that there is a danger that if people are going to forsake cable altogether, they're going to miss out on important content, and that doesn't serve the public interest as well. So that would seem to suggest that you ought to have more granular consumer choice so that you don't have large portions of the conservative world becoming less informed. That doesn't seem to be in anybody's self-interest, and I'll just leave that at that.
All right. Well, on another legislation and policy issue, actually, before we leave Miley, I just want to go around and see. We don't know. We're not parties to the dispute. We're simply on the sidelines. But if we're talking about unbundling and cable costs, we certainly should pay attention to the fact that Time Warner and CBS are still at each other's throats. And I'm just wondering what the over-under here is on them working this out before the NFL season starts. What do you think, Gordon?
I think CBS is going to have a real problem if they don't get a deal in place before football season, but before also the primetime television season. You know, their advertising revenues depend on them reaching the broadest audience they can. So, you know, they may have to back down a little bit on the retransmission fees that they want to collect. But on the other hand, you know, the cable companies, they're going to have to, everybody has to compromise. That's what it comes down to. And all of this is about turning the consumers against the cable company, turning, you know, getting them to find other ways of accessing the material. And I don't really see this. This is much ado about nothing. It's going to work itself out.
Yeah, and if it doesn't, I mean, they're going to lose viewers. They're going to lose customers. I know that I'm in the affected market. And although I am on every do not call list I can possibly be on, I've gotten calls from both DirecTV and Dish seeking to lure me over. Evan, any thoughts?
Sure would hate to miss the Manning Brothers matchup coming up in a couple weeks. So I have a feeling that'll have something to do with it.
Yeah. Allie, is this affecting you at all? You're in New York.
I mean, this in particular, I mean, I have cable vision for this one, but something similar happened a few years ago. I remember this. It was like the day of the Academy Awards, and ABC and Cablevision were having a problem. And it almost seemed like it was done on a purpose, because obviously they had to resolve it really quickly. Because everyone was angry. You couldn't even reach Cablevision that day to call and complain. I remember my family was really angry, and within like 20 minutes into the show, the problem had been resolved. So I don't know. It almost, sometimes it seems like they pick a perfect time, like now it's football season, so that the network kind of get what they want more.
Yep, I think there's probably something to that. All right, let's go out on a discussion of whether revenge porn should be a crime. The California Senate thinks so, and so does Danielle Citron, who has a great op-ed that Evan pointed me toward over at CNN. How does all this shake out, Evan?
This is a toothless piece of legislation. It's very well intended. Yes, revenge porn should be a crime. This won't solve the real problem, though. If you go to any of the big revenge porn sites, you see the real problem is selfies that people have texted to one another. Mm-hmm. Gordon, you're giggling.
Just that term
in such a way as to distract someone else while driving, no doubt.
Right, right. So Senate Bill 255 in California makes it unlawful for somebody to distribute photos that they've taken themselves. Not of themselves, but taken of others. This would only solve about probably 5% of the problem, though I haven't done any empirical research into what percentage of content on YouGotPosted.com is a selfie versus taken by someone else. But I think that this only goes part of the way, nonetheless.
So how would we go the rest of the way?
Make it unlawful to distribute a photo that you either took yourself or that was provided to you with an expectation of privacy.
There we go. Once again, forcing the court to decide whether or not the person can get into the head of who they're sending it to. Correct?
Well, it's not like we have to be clairvoyant to operate our legal system in the society. Evidence is all about proving what happened in the past. And so you look at circumstances, you look at content surrounding communications, you look at the nature of the relationship. You look at the understanding. You bring some, the finders of fact. You know, a jury coming in and finding facts isn't supposed to dispense with the things that they know from existing and from living in our society. I don't think a prosecutor would have any trouble at all coming in and demonstrating facts to show that a girl sent nude photos of herself to her boyfriend, and she understood that those were going to be kept private, and he went ahead and disclosed them anyway. I don't see any evidentiary problems with that at all, and I think that's something that we should be completely okay with. I know I hear it already. Other people saying First Amendment. I mean, the ACLU is already up in arms about the First Amendment issue here. This is not First Amendment protected speech, folks. This is harmful. This destroys people's lives. I mean, I have lost track of the number of young women that I've talked to who are victims of this. This destroys people's lives. You know, they lose jobs, they lose friends, they commit suicide. It's easy to make jokes about this, but this is obviously a crime, and the people who are responsible for the distribution of these photos in the first instance are criminals and ought to be held accountable.
Right. Let me just jump in and say that this is being dramatized right now on the newsroom, and Allie's good about not giving spoilers, and I'm going to be good too, and just say that there's a revenge porn plot on HBO's The Newsroom, which is fleshing through all of the issues that Evan just brought up, and whether you know there is no criminal liability that they are attempting to impose in the story, but there are some good consequences that flow from the fact that a photo intended to be private becomes public. So, Allie, there's one for you to perhaps try and unpack if you're not already watching that show.
Yeah, I was actually thinking maybe that will be the next show covered on my blog now, because it sounds like an interesting one to add. And the two shows I'm currently writing about just had the finales, so I'm looking for more content.
Well, there you go.
It's interesting because one of the shows in the second to last and a finale that I cover, Twisted, it had a similar thing happen, except it wasn't a picture somebody took on their own. There was an incident where somebody took a secret video of two people that definitely had an expectation of privacy. But so you'll probably be seeing that in my blog like next week. But I definitely think that one of the issues that's being brought up with this new bill that's being attempted, like in California, is that originally the person taking the picture was at the time given permission to take the picture, but obviously that doesn't mean they were given permission to send it to whoever they want, like disseminate it to a public audience.
Right. Gordon, this seems like an issue that it gains even more momentum when we're talking about the world of celebrities, because there you have all the same privacy considerations, but you know the ramifications can be even more destructive, if possible, to one's career or reputation.
I mean, I don't think it should matter whether the victim of this is a celebrity. There was that sportscaster.
Aaron Andrews,
about a year or two ago that had this very issue come. It wasn't revenge porn, but it was nude images of her being trafficked on the internet. I'm troubled, though, anytime you start criminalizing the act of sending a message, of sending content or distributing the photograph. At the sender's level, I guess I'd be okay with criminalizing the trafficking in this stuff for profit or for purposes other than which the initial creation of the work was intended. And so, I'm with you, Evan. It's a terrible, terrible thing. It does cause grave harm to people's lives, reputations, and whatnot. And yet, I also think that when we start to squeeze tighter on what's okay to make and share, we're starting to get into that, I'm going to say it again, slippery slope of, you know, where do we stop? When do we know, okay, that's too far? And so I'd hesitate to start regulating these kinds of things, you know, at all. That said, I think we have privacy laws that, you know, granted, it's civil liability, not criminal liability, and so there's lots of reasons why civil doesn't always work to disincentivize or deter this kind of bad behavior. But I have real reservations about this, and I'm really honest. I haven't read the California statute carefully enough to know, does it carve out exceptions for the kinds of things that need exceptions? I'm reminded of a Robert Mapplethorpe case a few years ago where he had made this photograph of a young child nude. It was an artistic photograph, and I think it was somewhere in Ohio, Cincinnati or Cleveland, the prosecutor actually prosecuted the curator of a gallery where this photograph was exhibited, and got a conviction on obscenity charges. And you know, maybe the obscenity laws are already good enough to deal with this kind of stuff, because I can go on and on about this, and I'm sort of rambling, but it troubles me. When it comes to celebrities, we've got the right of publicity stuff again.
Right.
And,
But the real harm is to somebody's identity when it comes to this, and their reputation.
To their psyche.
Those issues and the remedies that ought to be afforded are different than the ones, you know, with the child pornography case. And in any event, you know, here let me go ahead and try to make an argument to how criminalizing this would criminalizing the distribution would actually enhance creativity. There's probably a lot of people out there who don't consent to their photo being taken in these private contexts because they're afraid that it's going to be distributed. But if that person were assured that it wouldn't be distributed, maybe they would consent to the photos being taken in the first place. And so that's going to foster the creativity. What do you think of that?
Well, I have to say, I mean, I think that one extension of this kind of thing is when does it stop being okay to say in print, I had sex with so-and-so, or I saw so-and-so naked? You know, I think we'd have, it's not exactly the same thing, but the ideas go in the same direction. And I do think that there needs to be some tools in the prosecutor's toolbox to deal with the bad intent and causing these kinds of consequences. I'm just always troubled when it comes to you can't publish, you can't print, you can't send kinds of laws.
Right.
I just want to mention too, we're gonna have to pick up this thread next week when we have Michelle Dennedy joining us, who is the founder of the Identity Project, talking all about identity and privacy and reputation. So certainly something that we'd love to get her thoughts on next week as well. Let's see. Did I go ahead and put a second MCLE passphrase in yet? I think I did,
yes,
didn't
you did.
I? Yes. Okay,
yeah,
good.
I think so.
Just wanted to make sure I took care of that before we go on and give you our tips and resources of the week. Got a couple of tips this week. One of them is a great one if you are a company or individual who likes to promote yourself on Facebook through contests and sweepstakes. Having given some advice to clients along these lines and having had to navigate the weird non-legal but instead site policy rules that Facebook had in place before, they've now gotten rid of a number of those, which just makes it much easier to do the sweepstakes and contests. Evan's colleague James Rubin has a good piece on this over at the Info Law Group site. We've got it in our discussion points at delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/225. They've done some things like you used to have to use an app to run the sweepstakes, and now that's been removed. And there were some really strange hoops that you had to jump through. So somebody finally got wise to the fact that sweepstakes are already complicated enough to run, and that for sure, Facebook shouldn't be making it any more difficult. So that's a good thing. And Evan, you pointed to something cool on Twitter about debunking the urban legend of the poor man's copyright. You want to tell us about that?
Sure. Yeah, this is kind of it's an urban legend. That's how I characterize it in the tweet about it. Bill Wilson, he's a lawyer over in South Bend, Indiana. On his blog, the Indiana Entertainment Law, wrote a post about what is poor man's copyright. And this is that what you hear people talking about. Well, I'm going to print out a copy of the work or the photo or whatever and mail it to myself and keep it sealed. And so if I ever need to prove when I created it, I'll be able to show the postmark on it. And Bill does a good job of saying, you know, why that really doesn't matter. And copyright rights don't attach by doing that. It doesn't really do much to enhance your copyright rights. What you really need to have a full set of remedies is a timely registration. So it's an interesting little post about this relatively common misconception about what one must do to perfect his or her copyright rights. So it's a quick and easy to read little post, one that I recommend.
Hey, Gordon, isn't there a species of this that preys on screenwriters and tries to convince them that, or is that a legitimate thing, that you should, you know, register not with the U.S. Copyright Office, but with some private database whenever you've written a screenplay, and that gives you some sort of credibility as to being the originator at a certain time?
Yeah, the Writers Guild of America, the Union of Professional Screenwriters, does maintain a registry service, I guess. And the advantages of it, I mean, I always recommend doing copyright registration and the Writers Guild, if you're going to do the Writers Guild at all. Don't rely on it in lieu of the copyright registration, because it doesn't provide the full scope of remedies, and you're going to have to register anyway if you do have to file a lawsuit. But the advantage of the of the Writers Guild registration is that it's instantaneous. You walk it in, you pay a fee, they give you a certificate, they hold a copy on file for 10 years with the date stamp, so you can prove your timeline of this is the form this script was in on this date and time, and they will send somebody to court for you to testify to that, to that timeline. And that can be a powerful evidentiary tool in proving a copyright case, more powerful than saying, here's my copyright registration certificate. You've got this, you know, representative of the Writers Guild saying, yes, we received it, and this is the form it's in, and you can compare it, jurors, to the alleged infringing work or whatever. But for the money...
Okay, so the Writers Guild isn't a poor man's copyright. It's actually a rich man's copyright, because you have to pay the extra fee, and there is some value there.
It's open to non-members of the guild, and you do pay. The cost is the right. Same, I think, $35-$45 for the registration, and it has to be renewed and those kinds of things. So my recommendation to writers and all creators is just register the copyright.
All right. That's good to know. And if you are going to have someone from the Writers Guild go into court for you as a witness, or anybody else for that matter, you might want to check out this interesting site and service that you pointed to, Gordon. It's called The Perfect Witness. And for $119, it's a witness online prep course. So it's like a little course that people go through, their videos that they watch, and then they are tested at the end of every segment, all toward the end of making them a better witness in court. And while I have not gone through it and checked it out, it really seems to me like a nice idea and a good complement to whatever witness prep that you would do as a lawyer, because what you get is a report back that says, well, your witness did really well in this area and not so well in this area. So you know what you might want to focus on. Did you have any additional thoughts about that, Gordon?
Not really. What amused me, I'm sort of amused by the whole notion of it, that mm-hmm. we're going to substitute a bunch of machines and an algorithm for the nuance of prepping a witness. And, you know, I'm not a litigator. I don't prepare witnesses for much. Mm-hmm. But it seems to me that a lot can be evoked from body language and things that a computer can't sense. And so yes. I don't know how powerful this really is. Certainly it's an extra tool. And if I had a long witness list, I might want them to go through this first before we sit down for our prep session or something like that. It can't hurt.
Yeah, no, I definitely would not encourage anyone to replace actual discussions with your witness and preparation in advance of testimony. But this seems like a nice adjunct and could maybe shortcut some stuff for you. Mm-hmm. Evan, what do you think about all this?
I think this is a good thing. I mean, it's another example of the practice of law kind of being replaced by these technologies, because, you know, the career of a young litigator, he or she spends a lot of time meeting with witnesses, preparing them for depositions, for trial. And it really is, after a while, you recognize that it's very rote. You know, there's a certain portion of that, they call it woodshedding, where you take the witness out and get them prepared for their upcoming testimony. A lot of it is you tell them the same things, you know, make sure you actually answer the question being asked. The example is, suppose that I ask you, do you know what time it is? Most people will say, yeah, it's 2:54. But, you know, I say, no. The question I ask you is, do you know what time it is? And the answer is yes or no. So, you know, little things like that can be time consuming. There, I could have built a point one just for that, where instead of sending somebody to a video service like this. The point is, well-educated clients are a great thing. It helps the lawyers give good legal services, and to the extent that lawyers can provide people with good service, that benefits the profession, it benefits us all. So this is turning into like that crazy commercial of strange cause and effect. So we just saved the world by using this service, right?
Let's hope so. Allie, any thoughts?
I don't know how much I would trust a website like that. I feel like it would almost make the witnesses seem more like they had a rehearsal rather than telling the truth.
Yeah, that's an excellent observation. You certainly don't want all your witnesses to come across as automatons.
Yeah, because if they're getting lessons on pretty much what they should and should not say, I feel like it could take away from the authentic testimony.
Definitely. Well, so I think this is a useful resource for folks who might need to, you know, shorthand or shortcut or save some costs in witness prep, but certainly bear in mind all the caveats that we've been discussing here on the show. And with that, we'll go ahead and wrap up this episode of This Week in Law. It's been a really fun discussion. Great to have you back on the show, Gordon.
It's great. Great to be here. It's a lot of fun. Thank you for having me.
Our very great pleasure. Of course, you can find Gordon on Twitter. He's at gfiremark. GordonFiremark.com is his website. Anything interesting coming up in your world that people might be able to check out or attend?
I'm going to be speaking to the California Lawyers for the Arts the beginning of next month about legal issues for live performance and live venues and those kinds of things. Dancers, plays, those kinds of things. It's sort of a pet field for me.
Oh, that's great. Are you going to touch on, folks throwing their camera up, taking a clip and throwing it up on YouTube?
Yeah, we'll be talking about that. We'll be talking about some issues around the liability of the playwright or the producers of a play to audience members that might be injured in the course of the performance, or you know, when they get called up on stage. Remember the Blue Man Group case of a couple of years ago, the esophagus cam. Gag that they did.
Cam. No, I missed the esophagus cam. Well,
if you got a minute, I'll tell you. So the Blue Man Group has this gag where in their show, they bring somebody up on the stage and they apparently shove a camera down the guy's esophagus. And of course, it's a gag. You know, they cut to some existing footage and they just sort of hold the cable camera right there near the guy's mouth. Well, sure enough, they had someone sue them saying that, you know, they caused me irreparable injury by shoving this thing down my throat.
That's beautiful. No, I was thinking when you were saying liability to audience members, I was thinking of the Spider-Man set issues.
Those are sort of obvious liability issues, of course. But, right. You know, anyway, it's a fun area. I teach theater law class to lawyers looking for LLM degrees. And so this is a chance to explain it to the lay people in terms they'll understand.
That's cool. Where can people see you speak again?
That's the California Lawyers for the Arts here in Los Angeles on October 1st.
Wonderful. Allie, it's been such a pleasure meeting you. Love what you're doing at TVs and Law Degrees. Catchy title, fun stuff. Anything else you want to leave us with before we go on our ways here?
Thank you for having me too. And I definitely hope everybody keeps reading my blog, and I probably will be adding a newsroom to it in the near future.
Great. We look forward to your takes on the various legal issues that pop up in television programming, because they are always intriguing. And to those in the profession, they're often maddening that sometimes the TV writers take a little license with the way things might more realistically occur. Evan, it's been so fun again seeing you and discussing this week's cases with you. Thanks for your great thoughts, and thanks for knowing when to stop annoying yourself.
That's great. It takes years to figure that out, but finally you just get fed up and start sensing that. So yes, thank you. Wonderful time. Really enjoyed our conversation as usual. So thanks for keeping me around. It's a lot of fun.
It's been fantastic today. And if you've enjoyed the show and you want to join us on a weekly basis, we certainly hope you will. We record this show every Friday at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC at twit.tv. That's how you can join us live and participate in our IRC if you're so inclined, at irc.twit.tv. Otherwise, if you'd like to view more on your own schedule, please do. We've got a YouTube channel at This Week in Law is the handle there, youtube.com/thisweekinlaw. And our whole archive of shows is available on our show page at twit.tv/thisweekinlaw. You can find us on iTunes, on Roku, any way that you enjoy consuming your netcast entertainment, you're going to find us. And we certainly hope you will. If you'd like to find us between the shows, which is how we get great ideas from our audience members about the hot button issues that have been going on that we might want to cover, go over to facebook.com/thisweekinlaw. We have a page there. We have a page on Google Plus. Evan is Internet Cases on Twitter, and I am D Howell there. We love hearing from you there too. Or if you have something that you'd like to discuss in a less public venue, please email us. We've got denise@twit.tv and evan.twit.tv available for your use. We hope that you will put it to good use, and we hope you will continue enjoying This Week in Law. Thanks so much, everyone. Take care.